Liberation Spectrum by Cory Doctorow. Read by Leo Laporte. The tiny multinational lumbered across the Niagara Falls border in its tour bus. Lee Daniel at the wheel, sipping iced mocha from the flexible straw he'd threaded through a series of eyelets on his jacket. He'd been driving all the way since Akwesasne, reciting mnemonic sleep depth chants and steadily consuming the lethal blend of bittersweet chocolate and espresso. But after 20 straight hours, he was in deadly danger of falling straight to sleep and head-onning the bus into a Jersey barrier or a bullet train or a minivan. Once they were on U.S. soil, he pulled the bus over at a temporary roadhouse and set the handbrake. He eased himself out of the driver's perch, chafing his narrow ass and thighs to get the blood flowing there again, and gave forth a drawn-out gah as the pins and needles stabbed into his sweat-marinated muscles. He'd heard the rest of the company rousing itself behind him. First, the investors in the front row, then the rest of the board of directors in the row behind them, then four rows of middle managers, and finally the great mass of frontline workers, techs, customer service reps, troubleshooters, antenna men, switch women, chicken pluckers, and left-handed bottle stretchers. He flipped the windows to transparent and let the sun shine in, provoking groans from the company. McDermott, the angel investor who'd been in since the multinational had been able to fit into a sedan, threw a strong arm around Lee Daniel's shoulders. "You okay?" he said. The tone had phony solicitousness. McDermott and Lee Daniel had been through half a dozen disasters, from hostile takeover attempts to roadblocks to high-speed engine failure, and Lee Daniel knew a fake when he heard it. "I'm fixing to lay down and die," Lee Daniel said, stretching theatrically, his pipe cleaner arms straining. "You're street legal in New York, right? How about you drive the bus for the next couple shifts?" "Seriously," McDermott said. His black hair was showing gray now, but his eyebrows were still fierce and black, his eyes still sharp in their nest of whiskey-cured crow's feet. It was rare for Lee Daniel to cede the wheel to anyone else. It was his damned company, and he'd drive the damned bus. Lee Daniel saw the shareholder confidence eroding before his eyes. "Just for a while, okay? Not permanent, just for a day or two. Just long enough for me to get over the sleep deficit and regrow some stomach lining." It was hard being CEO of a mobile multinational. The shareholder oversight was murder. McDermott looked closely at him and smiled and gave him a burly man-hug that smelled of sandalwood soap and good liquor. "Yeah, of course, of course. I'll put it to the board meeting tonight at dinner. Can't have the CEO burning out at the wheel, that's what I'll say. Don't worry about it, LD." "Thanks, Mac," Lee Daniel said. "How about we get some eats?" He put his hand on the geometry reader beside the wheel, re-authenticated to the bus, then hit the hatches. Doors hissed open at the back, at the front, at the middle, fresh, dusty air rushing in all at once in an ear-popping whoosh. The bus knelt ponderously, and the company piled out. McDermott hustled away to join the rest of the investors, his exquisite handmade leather shoes slapping the paving, the cuffs of his wool tailor-made slacks shushing over their gleaming upper. And as Lee Daniel locked the bus down and armed it up, he watched the angel investor whisper in his co-shareholders' ears. Lee Daniel couldn't hear the words, but 6 years at the wheel of Cognitive Radio Incorporated had schooled him well in the body language of investors, and he knew his days with Cograd were numbered. The roadhouse was the kind of Taz that got less entertaining at the square of the amount of time spent within its animated walls. The first minute was painful, an overbright eternity of authenticating to the roadhouse area network and establishing credit with the system. Once they had their tokens, poker chips adorned with grinning, dancing, anthropomorphic dollar, euro, and yen symbols, there came the second minute, twice as horrible as the first, as they struggled in the guts of the giant vending machine, trying to fathom the actual products represented by the branded messages that tailored themselves to your personal demographic, your stated and implicit preferences, the messages that danced across your field of vision as you perused the racks in the roadhouse's aisles. The third minute was twice as horrible as the first 2 minutes, as you finalized your selections by waving your poker chip at the different displays, then tried to take receipts of your goods from the floor-level fulfillment chutes while fending off the imprecations of the upsell displays set into the floor tiles. Lee Daniel, people who bought tuna melts also bought 1,000-hour power cells. People who bought oral care mouth kits also bought My Guts brand edible oscopy cams. People who bought banana melatonin rice shakes also bought tailor-made sailcloth shirts by Figaro's of London and Rangoon. The horribleness of the roadhouse went asymptotic to infinity at minute 4. As you sat down and tried to eat your rubbery tuna melt, hunkered down at a table crowded with middle managers in need of reassurance, while swatting away the buzzing aerostats that probabilistically routed towards those diners with the highest credit ratings, delivering pitches whose tone and content had been honed by genetic algorithms that sharpened them to maximal intrusiveness and intriguingness. It took a genetic algorithm to make a high colonic sound like an afternoon at a spa. "I'm getting too old for this shit," said Joey Riel, a 17-year-old Métis whose fluency in English, French, and Ojibwa made him the youngest middle manager in Cograd history, 8 months before. He'd started griping about his road weariness within days of his promotion up from Antenna Man. It made him fit in with the other, older middle managers who were coffee-soured lifers whose time on the road had drummed out any footloose spirit they might once have possessed. Further down the arcade, the investors were waving their tokens over a trading table, playing the instant futures market. An aerostat overhead mirrored the gameplay. And as Lee Daniel watched, McDermott doubled his money on a short-odds bet on 2 cherries and a lemon. Then Earnshaw lost big when his long-odds investment on uranium and coal came back with 2 windmills and a photovoltaic array. "I'm into that, bro," said Elaine, who ran 2 squads of surveyors. She was all lean muscle and black fly repellent and mail-order outdoor wear, handily capable of living off the land for weeks while trekking the bush, homing in on optimal repeater locations. At the Akwesasne Sovereign, she'd broken the hearts of 6 starry-eyed Mohawk warriors who'd puppy-dogged after her as she slept the length and breadth of their territory, war-chalking neon arrows to indicate RF shadows cast by especially leafy trees and outcroppings of granite Canadian shield. That was before the Sûreté de Québec arrived on the scene, and it all went pear-shaped. "Me too," said Mortimer, the security man, who really was too old for this shit, Lee Daniel reflected, scratching at his fussy little caterpillar mustache. He'd been protecting the old dodderer from the board of directors, who saw him as an insurance nightmare. Mortimer's hands shook. He was night blind, and he was 98 years old, and there wasn't enough rejuve in the world to give him the mental flexibility required by the modern age. Lee Daniel had stripped him of his firearms, even the non-lethals, at the same time as he'd promoted Joey Riel. Now Mortimer carried a loudhailer through which he could bark orders in his old cop voice, the voice that made your asshole clench up and your shoulders itch for a soon-come bullet. The investors howled again, and the aerostat told them all that McDermott had cleaned up big time, paying out 100-1 on an investment in Shell Oil collectibles, 2 derricks and a shell. The Series A, Series B investors crowded around him, giving him awestruck backslaps. The other 2 might be the fronts for gigafunds, but that's all they were, fronts. They were the voice of the money while the company was on the road, junior associates who needed to make a good score on their wander yard if they wanted to make partner. Mac was solo money, a shrewd individual investor who'd acquired his 15-share in Cograd with no more investment than a year's worth of gas and roadhouse meals while Lee Daniel was getting the show on the road. "The rich get richer and the poor get children," Joey Riel said, shaking his head at the investors and the board, carrying McDermott off to a private dining room for their dinner and nightly board meeting. "Those Mohawks got you all full of bullshit horseshit, didn't they?" Mortimer said. The Mohawk Warrior Society talked a good anarcho-syndicalist line. Most of the sovereigns at Cograd Unwired were interested in setting up a local telco as part of some economic development scheme. As far as they were concerned, tax-free packets were the new tax-free cigarettes. But the Mohawk warriors in Quebec were in it for the SAMHSA data. They had big plans for their cognitive radio network. They'd peered with 2 upstate New York networks and an Algerian satellite backbone, and they were reselling enciphered proxy time on their network to anyone who wanted it, providing an anonymizing relay for any and all data, regardless of origin, destination, or payload. Lee Daniel knew he should have gotten them to pay up front. Nothing got the black shirts interested in private wireless networking like routing suspicious real-time chatter between Burmese guerrilla cells and suspected movie swappers in D.C. But that wasn't how COG radio had been built. The native bands that were desperate enough to assert that their ancestral treaties didn't encompass the RF spectrum couldn't afford to lay out cash for Cog Radio's hardware, training, and remote administration. Cog Radio was as much a bank as a technology startup. But the Canadian government took a hard line on anything that looked like separatism. Four Cog Radio employees who'd been unlucky enough to get stuck on the wrong side of the barricades during one of the Warriors' traditional shootouts with the Sûreté wouldn't be coming back to work for 10 to 15, eight with good behavior. With the investors out of sight, the managers and the frontliners shucked off their veneer of civility and began to get wild, ordering drinks and health insurance and validating carbo treats. Elaine sucked down three tequila cartons and glared bleary hostility at him. "Fuck you know about anything, hey?" she said. "You're supposed to be in charge of things, but you don't take a shit without clearing it with those bastards." She jerked her head over her shoulder at the closed door of the private dining room. "And when you do make a decision, you fuck it up." The smell of old sweat and booze made his eyes water. Mortimer hitched himself erect, creaking up from his seat. "That's enough of that," he said in his cop voice, laying a still strong hand on Elaine's shoulder. "If you don't like your job, you can give notice, but you'll keep it polite as long as you're working here." Elaine tried to shake his hand off, but he kept his grasp firm. Lee Daniel had been through one or two of these in the first year, and he knew Mortimer knew what he was doing. Things could get awfully heated up at times like this. "You're hurting me," Elaine said. "Let go." "Apologize to the man," Mortimer said, the voice of authority. "You're out of line." Joey Riel leapt on Mortimer's back, his arms locked around Mortimer's neck. "Don't touch her, you pig," he hissed. Mortimer took hold of Joey's thumb and twisted it into a come-along, and Joey let go, dancing around and clutching his hand. "You broke my fucking thumb," he said. And then Elaine was on her feet, shouting incoherently right up in Mortimer's face, darting her head at him like a striking cobra. The frontliners broke off their gaming and boozing and necking and rushed over, hooting for blood. Lee Daniel felt the old adrenaline, the leadership brain reward that he got when it came down to a crisis. He jumped up on their table, scattering their dinner's active packaging, which curled and waved as it flapped to the floor, cycling through its upsell ads. "Enough!" he roared. It wasn't a cop voice, but it was a voice, nevertheless, the voice of the man who signs the paycheck, the disappointed father who was going to turn the bus around and take the company home this instant if he didn't get respect. Lee Daniel didn't have to use that voice often, but its rarity was part of its effectiveness. It didn't work. Elaine still shouted. Joey Riel was still digging through the drifts of trash for a weapon, and the frontliners were still cheering their bosses on. "Enough," he said, just to check. But it didn't work any better the second time around. He got down off the table and circled Mortimer, who had the mic for his loudhailer clipped to his belt. Lee Daniel snatched it up and hit the talk button, dialing the volume up to max with his thumb. "Enough," he said, and the loudhailer amplified his voice to a staggering volume. At max, it was meant to be used to signal passing aircraft. Inside the vending machine's claustrophobic bowels, it was like a bullet ricocheting through their skulls. Some of the more delicate antenna men dropped to their knees, their hands clutched to their heads, and Mortimer staggered back into Lee Daniel, nearly knocking him off his feet. Lee Daniel cut the volume in half and hit talk again. The company shied back when the speaker array on Mortimer's bandolier popped to life. "All right, company meeting, get chairs, sit on the floor, whatever, right here, right now." He handed the mic back to Mortimer, who wiped it down with care and clipped it back to his belt. He gave Mortimer his poker chip. "Get a bag of ice for Joey," he said. "And thanks, man." Mortimer gave him the cop stare and trudged off to one of the vending banks and started prodding methodically at its display. "All right," Lee Daniel said again, looking into the expectant upturned faces of his company. "All right. It's been a rough week for all of us, but we've had rough weeks before. Remember Wisconsin? That was in our first year, and the FCC looked like it was going to impound every bit of gear we owned. We spent a month on the reservation, borrowing and borrowing to pay off the lawyers. No one got paid. I ate enough venison and cornbread to last me a lifetime. Wisconsin was legendary. That was when they'd acquired the Series A investor, who'd converted its debt instruments to capital when the Lac du Flambeau Ojibwa signed up their 1,000th customer and started sending royalties to the company's e-gold account. Only Mortimer had actually been with the company long enough to remember the incident firsthand, which was good, since 3/4 of the company had quit after the third week, and he'd had to fire 2 more when they got caught hitting on some of the women on the res. "But we saw it through," he said, looking significantly at Mortimer, who kept mum. "And we'll see this through. You might think that it was a mistake to go to Canada, and I understand why it might seem that way to you, but let me put your mind at ease. It wasn't a mistake. It was a risk that we took to expand this business. If you want your options to be worth something someday, this company's going to have to grow. We've been growing at 20% per quarter for the past 3 years, and that's right on track. Maintaining that growth is going to necessitate excursions outside of the USA. We'll be going back to Canada. Better prepared, wiser, more cautious, but we'll be going back. The Caribbean, too, South America, and Mexico. I shouldn't have to tell you that radio has no borders. Wherever there's unencumbered spectrum, we'll be there. There's never going to be a routine job, whatever that means. Every job will be different. If you're looking for a routine job, you're in the wrong business. We're headed for the Seneca Sovereign in Cattaraugus next. There'll be a week of R&R there, fishing, hunting, gaming. They have a decent theater there that's doing a Beckett revival, and I've got half-price tickets if you want them. Half-price tickets for those who stay, that is. Because I want to make one thing clear. If you don't like the way I run this company, you shouldn't put up with it. Give me your notice. I'll cut you a check, and you can get lost. That's your remedy. That's your only remedy. I'll be sitting right here if any of you want to give your notice tonight. He sat down at a table and helped himself to someone's carton of Crantini, gave it a shake to cool it down, then took a nonchalant sip. The silence was broken by the door to the investor's dining room hissing open. The Series A investor stepped out into the chaos of the main concourse and crooked a finger at Lee Daniel. "We'd like to speak with you, if we may," he said, and swung the door wide. Aqua Sazne was supposed to be a cakewalk. The Canadian Radio and Television Commission, Canada's RF feds, were softies, more worried with ensuring that 30% of the entertainment product on the airwaves was Canadian content than with monitoring ultra-low-power, ultra-wideband cognitive radio experiments in rural Quebec. The Mohawk Warrior Society, whose reservation was a Siamese twin with another res in upstate New York, were accustomed to the American way of doing biz, had even underwritten MBAs for a bunch of the bros, which explained the animated growth charts backlinked to hundreds of diverse spreadsheets maintained by research committees across the continental Mohawk Nation infrastructure. But they did indeed talk a line of bullshy horseshit in the Mohawk Warrior Society. The first hint came from the guard in the pillbox at the Aqua Sazne main gate. The COG radio magic bus pulled up, abuzz with new gig energy. The anticipation of 30 skilled professionals had been crammed into a bus for 4 solid days, ready to tear each other's throats out. The gatewoman was all of 17, not that you could tell at first, so crufted up was she with obsolete Martian armors, arms, and sensory array. But once she came onto the bus for her customs inspection and removed her immersive headgear, it was obvious she was no older than the switch girls who drifted in and out of the Cograd bus, using it as a means of making a little e-gold between footloose adventures in the great American heartland. A 17-year-old with a defensive array of fast-acting anti-serotonin misters was a lot less threatening than a 30-year-old would have been, and orders of magnitude less terrifying than a similarly armed, innovation-sick 50-year-old would have been. Joey Riel came forward, stinking of something between sweat socks and Doritos, and greeted her in familiar, colloquial French, something flirty by the sound of it, and she gave him a wry, patronizing smile. "Why do you speak French, brother? Why not greet me in Kanyangeha, or Cree, or even Ojibwe? When we speak white man words, they make us think white man thoughts." She turned to the bus and gave them a long stare. "Hello, white men," she continued. "Hello, white women. Welcome to the Mohawk Warrior Society Autonomous Zone. No weapons. No sex with first people, no drinks or drugs, no white man tobacco. Cook your own meals, wash your own plates, step lightly on the land. You can observe our nightly meetings if you are respectful, but it's more important that you come to the seminars afterwards. There are lectures, role-playing exercises, personal storytelling, theater of the oppressed, news blogging, war blogging, link blogging, puppet making, outreach, filibustering. White man guests are welcome here, provided they're willing to help the cause." Lee Daniel had heard variations on this speech before, but they usually came from hotheads who argued against renewing Cograd's maintenance contract, not the official greeter, before they'd even started the gig. He knew well enough to take it in stride and move on. But Joey Riel was blushing furiously at having been shot down for insufficient Indianity by this highly macho hottie, and so he waved some verbal dick, asking something in Ojibwe, all testicular. She fixed him with a withering stare. "You're not the first apple I've met," she said. "Apple, red on the outside, white on the inside. And you're not the most pathetic, but you're an apple, and you've forgotten who you are, and that means you don't mean anything to me except a sad story and a warning to other first people." Joey Riel's hands balled into fists, and the investors shifted nervously. Lee Daniel got to his feet and interposed himself between them. "Yatehe, madam," he said. "Thank you for your welcome. Can you tell me where I should park the bus? We've got a lot of work to do today while there's still light to work by." "You need to understand, it's not personal," McDermott said for the third time. Lee Daniel set down his ridiculous second-hand Crantini carton and climbed slowly to his feet. "You need to understand, Mac, that I don't care if it is personal. Whether you're forcing me out of this company that I built with my own two hands, this company that is hitting every goddamn milestone, this company that is returning good dividends on your preferred stock, whether you're forcing me out because you're not my friend anymore," he said this in a pinched Mickey Mouse voice, "or whether you're forcing me out because you think it's for the best, doesn't matter to me at all. I don't care if you're doing it because you're protecting your investment or because your astrologer told you to. I still won't stand for it." The Series A and Series B investors, who'd started off looking uncomfortable, visibly squirmed during this. They weren't accustomed to interpersonal conflict in the course of conducting their affairs, but Mac took it all in stride. Angels have to be prepared to slug it out to protect their investment. "You don't get to stand for it, LD," McDermott said, sipping at a frosty can of slushy ginseng-infused Long Island iced tea. "You don't get a say in it. When the investors are united, you don't have the equity to overrule us. The severance package is generous, the non-compete is lightweight, and you get to go with your dignity intact." He didn't need to add that fighting the board would mean a significant change to that picture. "What did they promise you, Mac?" Lee Daniel asked. He shrewdly chosen his investors for their mutual animosity, believing that bitter enemies like the Series A Giga Fund and the Series B Terra Fund would never come together, and that Mac, who'd been screwed on deals by principals from both funds, would never toss his lot in with them. "What do you have that's worth throwing away this entire investment?"
"No one's throwing away anything. There comes a point in any business's life cycle where the founders get out of their depth, and we need to transition in a professional CEO. You've done a good job with Cograd, LD, and we recognize that. But if we're going to ensure steady growth, we need seasoned leadership."
"Seasoned?" he barked a laugh. "Mac, I invented this business. We're 5 years ahead of our closest competitors, who only got that far by copying stuff I invented. Who the hell could be possibly more seasoned than me?"
"You've never run a Fortune 5 company," the Series A man said. "You've never had more than 50 people working under you. Executive search for..."
McDermott waved a hand, crusted with three class rings, at the gesticulating Series A punk, who barely looked old enough to smoke. He'd only been out of B-school for a year, and he'd only been on the bus for a month, but here he was, telling Lee Daniel that they'd blown corporate funds, money he'd earned, on a slick-ass headhunter who'd spent it getting old frat brothers laid at fancy hotels on Hawaii while negotiating how much of Lee Daniel's company they would end up with once they stole his job from him. The punk shut up.
"Mac," Lee Daniel said, sitting down again, pulling up a chair. "Come here, Mac. Take a seat. Talk to me. I want to hear this from you, from the beginning."
Mac stood, exchanging significant looks with the Series A and Series B investors.
"Come on, Mac, screw that. You and me, end to end."
That was Cograd jargon from back in the old days. The internet was end to end, which meant that any two points could communicate without an intermediary interfering in the byte stream. In Cograd, you didn't talk person to person or man to man. You talked end to end, just like the connectivity they brought to the res.
"I own 15% of this company, same as you. You owe me a decent explanation."
McDermott stood fast.
"Get in the fucking chair, Mac," Lee Daniel said, hating the whine in his voice. "If you want me to go along with this, get in the fucking chair."
"Mac, I'm sorry if I flew off the handle. I'm a grown-up. You're a grown-up, and we both care about Cograd. Get in the chair and tell me about this, please."
McDermott sat.
"Listen up, LD. You've done excellent work here. Be proud. You started something good, something that will grow and grow, and that you can retire on. But you can't keep this up forever.
If I thought for a second that you'd take orders from someone else, I'd offer to keep you on as a COO or a VP of research and development. There's no way, though. No one would ever be able to tell you what to do in this company. You're great at the dirty work. You can get a crew onto a res, get the terminals sighted and installed and burned in. You can boss a bunch of egomaniacs and social retards on long road trips. For 6 years, we've needed someone at the helm who could do all that stuff. But it's time to settle into the next phase. We're going abroad, and it needs a delicate touch. If Canada ends up in a firefight, what'll it be like in Guatemala? Lee Daniel and his people had had to work around a lot of surveying constraints. There had been a burial ground at the Moapa River Indian Reservation that was freaking perfect for a repeater array with a commanding view of the entire goddamned res. But no matter how tempted the Paiute elders were by the thought of getting out of the cutthroat slots biz and instead taking a piece of every casino's action by offering secure connectivity for phones and data, they couldn't see their way clearer to permitting Cograd's surveyor crew to head up there and start hammering in stakes for the repeaters. The Aguasazne warriors took the cake, though. A fat, middle-aged man in camo fatigues decorated with powwow badges, who called himself Meatloaf, gave them a 2-hour briefing. He had a topo map of the res and the surrounding areas stuck up on the wall of the school auditorium, and they sat around it in the fading light of the sun that streamed through the steel-reinforced windows. The areas that have post-its are strategic. No one except a warrior goes within 20 meters of these. 60 feet, Lee Daniel translated for the surveyors and antenna men, who were products of the American educational system and hence impedance mismatched with the entire metric-speaking world. 60 feet, Meatloaf said. You know you've gotten too close if you find yourself at the bottom of a 10-foot pit with two broken legs. Don't go near the strategic areas, okay? Elaine stood up and began to pace the map's length. She unsnapped a laser pointer from a gear pig bandolier and began to hit each strategic area in turn. All the high ground, right? Meatloaf nodded. The perimeter too, right? He nodded again. Elaine gave Lee Daniel a look, then ran the dot of her pointer over each of the strategic areas again. Some of the surveyors groaned and whispered to the antenna men and the switch girls. Lee Daniel cleared his throat. Meatloaf, he said, all respect, but this won't work. Our radios operate on line of sight. If we can see it, we can shoot it at half a gigabit a second. Slower if there are a lot of leaves and stuff in the way. If we can't see it, we can't shoot it. 0 bits a second. We need high ground. We need perimeter. Otherwise, we're just wasting your time. Meatloaf shook his head. Radio radiates. I can't see the cell tower, but I can still reach it with my phone. That's dumb radio, Lee Daniel said. If we want to have a conversation and we're out of sight of one another, we can communicate, but only if we shout. That's fine for us, but not so good for the people between us, right, Mortimer? Mortimer, who'd been through 100 or 200 of these demos before, took his cue from outside the doorway, hitting it with a loud hailer dialed up about halfway.
Right,
he said. That's how dumb radio works. You had a bunch of bands that you could communicate in, cellular, TV, AM, FM, cops, air traffic, whatever, and rules and licenses for each governing how loud everyone gets to shout. Taking their cues, the Cograds started to gabble all at once, in stripes through the ranked chairs, saying, AM, 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 or TV, 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 or cellular, cellular, cellular. Smart radio, cognitive radio, is much more clever. Instead of shouting loud enough to be heard across the entire distance, cognitive radios cooperate with one another. When I need to talk to Mortimer, I first check around to see what channels are least occupied and most close to me, and then I send my message to the best candidate. He turned to Elaine, who had come to stand by his shoulder. Tell Mortimer it's time to come back, he said. Elaine turned to a switch girl, who'd positioned herself a few feet away, and said, Tell Mortimer it's time to come back, she said. The switch girl turned, but the next person in the chain, a customer service rep, had his phone headset in and was having a hushed support call. It was faked, just part of the script, but he gave a good impression of helping someone tech a network problem at a distance, tracking a non-existent support script across his HUD and prodding at the air with a data glove. Aha! Lee Daniel said. Here's where it gets tricky. What if one of the radios between us is too busy to relay a message? We've got two options. We can wait, which we'll do if we have to, but it adds latency to the message. Or we can find an alternate path. The switch girl, a network engineer he'd hired himself from a backwater DeVry at a job fair in Tulsa, who ran a little to fat but was still broad-shouldered from her time on the rowing machine she slept compulsively from gig to gig, facts that Lee Daniel could recall with ease, even if he couldn't remember her name, turned back and passed the word on to a surveyor who was standing a little ways out of the way, who related to Joey Riel, who was by the doorway, who stuck his head out into the corridor.
Mortimer sauntered back into the auditorium. He put the mic to his lips and boomed, "You want something, boss?" Lee Daniel clamped his hands to his ears along with the rest of the crew. "No need to shout," he said to Mortimer. "Is there?" he said to Meatloaf. "So what's the critical path, Mac?" Lee Daniel asked. "Who's going to run this circus between tonight and your executive search coming through with an empty suit to sit in the driver's seat? We thought you'd stay on LD, help with a smooth transition." "Why would I do that?" Lee Daniel said. The Series A and Series B investors watched them like a tennis match, silent, eyes shining. "Why don't you two get us a couple of beers, okay?" Max said to them. They mooched off petulantly. "LD, I hope you'll stay on because you have a significant stake in this company. We don't want to dismantle Cograd. We want to grow it, turn it into something big and important. We need your help still to make this work. It's your show, we know it. We can't make the transition without you." He knew that Mac was blowing smoke, massaging his ego, but he was good at suppressing his ego for the good of the company. The company, not his company anymore. "What's in it for me?" Mac made a face and leaned in close. "Look, they don't want you to stay. I had to fight hard to keep you in, even during the transition. I put a lot on the line for you. I know that your job can't just be filled by a warm body. I know you're the only one who can train your successor. We can make this company really big. You'll be able to retire on your share in 18 months if we go according to plan. We're going to franchise out, start new buses in Latin America, Asia, and Africa in 4 months, turn it all into a turnkey solution, something that scales. We'll raise $10 billion on IPO if we raise a cent. You just watch. I've been through this, LD. I know what a success smells like. This will be a success, your success, if you play along. If you don't, well, we could all end up in the shitter. Canada was the last straw for them. We either go on without you, or we don't go on at all. Do you understand?" The Series A and Series B men returned with a couple of novelty beers in aerosol cans. Mac and Lee Daniel sprayed their throats with the brew and swallowed, making faces. This was high style in the circles of Series A and Series B men traveled. "I see," Lee Daniel said. "So I either walk out of here as interim CEO, knowing that I'm gone in a couple of weeks, or I walk out of here fired. Is that the deal?" "That's the deal," the Series A man said. "And I don't see anyone offering anything better." McDermott gave him a shut-up asshole look, then spread his hands out. "When I raised money from you, we did it over the course of several weeks. We talked to lawyers. They exchanged documents. I don't think it's reasonable for you to expect me to sign anything now without at least consulting a lawyer." "You want several weeks?" the Series A man said with mock incredulity. "Half an hour," Lee Daniels said. "I don't think that's too much to ask." They settled for warrior escorts for the antenna men and the surveyors. The warriors were resentful at first, but they came around. Lee Daniel went out with a crew that Elaine was leading, up on the northern border of the Sovereign. She had two junior surveyors with her, all of them loaded with positioning gear that tied into Galileo, the European GPS network. The Galileo gear cost a fortune, but they'd found that their American GPS kits often mysteriously stopped working when they were working on projects in the territorial USA. They'd ordered the Euro stuff from a bunch of anti-globalization activists who'd found that the same thing happened in any city hosting an economic summit. Europeans were more likely to treat infrastructure as sacrosanct, while the U.S. was only too happy to monkey with GPS for tactical reasons. The surveyors and the warriors kept their distance as they set out, one warrior leading and one bringing up the rear. Elaine would call for a break every 5 or 10 minutes and do magic with her many devices, chattering into her cell phone to communicate with the other crews, make sure they weren't overlapping or diverging too widely. The woods had a high canopy, which was good news. When they started out, they'd focused on getting above the leaf line, since leaves badly scattered the RF signals. But they'd ended up with networks that were only reachable by people who were 20 feet off the ground. They'd blown a fortune downlinking the relays to ground-level stations with omnidirectional Yagi antennae. But then Lee Daniel had a brainstorm. Build a network below the leaf line. Heavy canopies starved out any foliage that grew below the treetops, leaving a clear line of sight, modulo the tree trunks, which were largely RF transparent, on the forest floor. That pushed Cograd from a theoretical project to a real success, and Aguasazne was just the sort of woods the Cograd gear thrived in. Within a week, the entire res would be unwired at 500 megabits a second, enough connectivity to move whatever data they could find a use for. The frontmost warrior, a girl of about 16, started off treating Elaine's halts as a nuisance, But after the fifth one, when Elaine unshipped some especially tasty laser-based theodolites and a high-sensitivity digital altimeter, the girl's curiosity overcame her, and she crowded in close to watch Elaine work. She didn't say anything, but thereafter it was clear that she was fascinated by Elaine and her masterful use of all her toys, bangles, and bobs. Elaine noticed it, of course. She was like a magnet for teenaged girls. Competent, beautiful, in charge. At the next stop, she handed the girl a can of pink spray chalk and directed her to mark the sight lines. The girl almost dropped the can, but then recovered and puffed up a bit, marching off to lay down the hot pink lines. The warrior at the rear, a man of indeterminate age who wore a camo balaclava, rolled his eyes, but that was okay. Lee Daniel was figuring out a way to get him engaged, too. At the next stop, a bare ridge that overlooked the woods on one side and the public highway on the other, Lee Daniel tapped the other warrior on his shoulder, then gestured at a travois on which Elaine's juniors had been hauling their satellite tester. He cocked his head, then bent down to take one end, and the other warrior fell in at the other end. The two juniors looked relieved and hitched up their packs, breaking out protein bars from their belt pouches. And so it went. By the time they reached the next ridge, the girl, Mermaid, had introduced herself, and the man, Cobra, had done likewise, removing his balaclava to reveal a middle-aged face, handsome but for the deep acne scars. And so it went, for all the Cograd crews, who'd never had explicit training in making friends with the locals on a gig, but who had learned from the example set by Lee Daniel and by the middle managers who'd learned it from him. Elaine gave Mermaid a cheap theodolite with an integrated compass, GPS, and altimeter, and a little booklet on how to use it. And the next time Lee Daniels saw her, she was leading a group of even younger girls on a series of surveying missions around the Indian school. "Privacy, please," he said. "We're standing all the way over here," the Series B man said from across the little table. "How much more privacy do you want?" Lee Daniels shook his head in exaggerated disbelief. And then McDermott led them back out to the communal area. Once they were gone, he flipped open his phone and called Jory Riel. "What?" he said. "You're fired," Lee Daniel said. "I hate to do it, kid, but it's coming down from the investors. You, Elaine, all the customer service reps, all but the two most senior antenna men and switch girls." "What the fuck?" Jory Riel said. "Keep it down," Lee Daniel said. "Just keep it easy. They're coming out now to do a head count and sort out the order for the firings. They're going to do it in small groups. I wanted to let you know because you've only just gotten your promotion, so you might get severance at the old salary level. So I thought I'd give you a little extra time to make some calls and line up some money before the roadhouse cuts off your credit. You're going to need a ride, too." "What?" Jory Riel said. He sounded purple, ready to burst. He cursed in three languages. "You heard me. Keep it to yourself, okay? I gotta go." He snapped his phone shut, wondering how long it would take before everyone in the company knew. 5 minutes? 10? He called his lawyer. It wasn't his idea to bring the investors along the perimeter walk. That was just a purely ceremonial event, only initiated once the real post-install survey had been completed, and he was sure that there was network integrity. But the networks must not only be integrated, they must be seen to be, etc. So they split into four crews and walked the perimeter. They used ruggedized video conferencing tablets as they went, digital clipboards whose screen was divided into a 2x2 grid, each square with the feed from one of the crews. The data went out over the local net and streamed out over the uplinks to residents of any other unwired sovereign that wanted to welcome the newest res to the party. The four parties each took a direction and hiked out to the most distant corner of the res and then began walking counterclockwise, keeping in constant communication. A little blinking light in each quadrant mapped the throughput to and from that host. 5 bars all the way and not a single frame dropped if all went according to plan. The investors were with the Northeast party, along with Joey Riel, Meatloaf, and Mermaid. Not Mac. He was on the bus, where he usually spent the dusks and dawns in air-conditioned gloom out of the mosquitoes' range. But the Series A and B men went northeast, while Lee Daniel took the opposite corner, southwest, with Elaine and the hard-line girl from the gate on the first day, and Cobra, who'd taken to watching the sunsets with him and sharing a pint of bourbon, not saying anything. They reached the perimeter and began to pace it off. Over the audio on the video conferencing tablets, he heard the investors' labored breathing, the slipping of their impractical Oxfords on the slippery humus that carpeted the floor. It was a nice early fall day, with bloody streaks of sunset on the horizon, and the crisp smell of damp and wind and sap dripping from the maples. Lee Daniel loved an autumn walk in the woods. Hell, who didn't? And so he was pretty relaxed by the time he got halfway round the res, an hour later, in the growing gloom. It was then that bright beams of light stabbed at them from all sides. Behind him, he heard Cobra curse, and then he was shoved aside and down as Cobra and the girl took up back-to-back positions with their weapons, a gas fogger for her, a hunting rifle for him, at ready.
Sûreté, Cobra hissed. Sûreté du Québec, the provincial cops.
He'd done the research, knew that the SQ and the Warriors hated each other. The Mohawk Warriors Society had been fired in a kiln bricked with SQ beatings, shootouts, and gassings. But the Aguasazne Rez had been at peace for almost 3 years. Why the hell couldn't this have happened tomorrow, when they were on the road? Lee Daniel knelt down and dialed down the screen brightness on his tablet, then peered at it. His own quadrant showed his long, narrow face, uplit like a jack-o'-lantern by the screen, eye sockets black and deep, cheeks hollow and stippled with patchy 3-day beard. Two of the other quadrants were black. The tablets were offline or broken. The final one showed the Northeast Party. Skinny Joey Riel holding a thick branch in one hand and a rock in the other, ridiculous alongside Meatloaf and Mermaid, who had already fitted their masks and goggles and drawn their sidearms, crouching back to back against each other. The investors hove into view, wave-faced, lips skinned back from their teeth, eyes crazy white.
"Get down," Lee Daniel said, leaning into the mic. "Head to the bus."
"It's dark," the Series A man said, jinking from foot to foot, making the camera sway seasick.
"The bus," Lee Daniel said. "Get in the bus. Get everyone to the bus. This isn't our fight."
He looked around for Elaine, but he didn't see her. Headed for the bus. That's what you did in an emergency. Fuck. It was an emergency. There was an even trampling of feet ahead of him, behind him, to his left and right. He stood slowly and put his hands in the air.
"I'm not a combatant," he said,
loudly but in a steady voice. He walked toward the bus, hands still in the air.
"I'm not a combatant," he said again.
A laser dot climbed his toe, his leg, centered on his gut. He looked down at it.
"They will shoot you, you know," Cobra said. "They shoot. They think they're playing cowboys and Indians."
He sounded very calm.
"I'm not a combatant," he said again, taking another step forward.
A second red dot joined the first, climbing his leg and resting within inches of the first, dancing and bobbing like a firefly. From the woods, someone barked in French.
"I surrender," Lee Daniel said.
"They don't speak English when they don't want to," Cobra said. "If I were you, I'd get down and stay down."
Then he yelled something defiant in French. The girl behind him tittered nervously.
"Cobra's making them mad," she said, giggling again.
Lee Daniel turned around slowly, getting away from the harsh white light. Green blobs swam in his vision. He began, very gently, to sink to his knees, when out of the corner of his eye, he spotted Elaine and two of her crew, in silhouette, up in the boughs of a maple they must have climbed as soon as the SQ arrived on the scene. More steps from the brush, the light coming closer. Cobra called out more French. 3 lights on him, his rifle at his shoulder. 2 laser dots danced on him, and Lee Daniel had an irrational urge to slap them away like horseflies. The young girl hit her fogger, spraying a thick, opaque cloud of gas.
"Cover your eyes," she said, and giggled again.
Lee Daniels pulled his shirt up over his face and dropped. He belly crawled blindly toward where he thought Elaine and her crew had been treed. He knocked his head on a tree trunk and gasped involuntarily, getting a lungful of the gas, which made him retch into the depths of his shirt, bringing on more gasps and more retching. He rolled for the clearing's edge, hit another tree, and got to his knees, heaving like a dog. He still had hold of the tablet, and when he could open his eyes again, he looked into it, saw the investors still staring at him, wide-eyed.
"Go!" he hissed. "Jesus, get to the goddamn bus!"
"Are you all right?" they said.
"I'm fine," he said. "Go, go, go!"
The Cograd drunk-ons were legendary. When you spent weeks at a time in the deep bush on dry reservations, lugging gear and fighting with bitch physics, you needed to unwind.
On the off days, it was traditional for a drunken riot to ensue. Lee Daniel occasionally partook, enough to be friendly, but never so much that he lost control. He set a sane example, and the crew followed it. And so the most harm that the big booze-on would cause was a gang-wide Neolithic hangover, swampy and hot and damp. But the drunk-on that was proceeding when Lee Daniel stumbled out of the dining room was like a heavily sponsored Bosch painting. Elaine was alternately necking with and slapping Joey Riel. Mortimer was collapsed on a heap of still-steaming rum toddy cartons. The customer service reps were playing kick the can with their ringing cell phones. The aerostats and the advertorial screens had automatically adjusted to overcome the ambient noise level and were consequently pitching their jingles and come-ons at megaphone levels. The Series A and Series B men were huddled together out front of the roadhouse along with McDermott. "That's some scene, huh, boss?" Lee Daniel remarked as he stepped into the cool night, sucking up the fresh air and the moonlight. "What did you tell them?" the Series A man said. "Tell them?" he said. "They think they're all fired," McDermott said. "Why do they think that?" "Just road crazies, like when they all thought they had West Nile. They get worked up. Egomaniacs and social retards." He was speaking in the grudging half-sentences that Cobra had preferred. Talking like that made him feel crazy and brave and alien. "What are you going to do about it?" the Series B man said. "Nothing," Lee Daniel said. There was a crash from the bus. One of the surveyors had beaten in the safety glass skylight and dropped down inside. They watched a headlamp's beam jump crazily around the bus's interior, high, low, left, right. "What's he doing?" the Series A man said. Lee Daniel knew that the surveyor in the bus snored, that he did tricks with a butterfly knife, that he sent money home to his little sister in Muncie. He couldn't remember his names. He was no good with names, but he knew his people. "What you do, you get fired, stealing office supplies." The surveyor crawled out back of the sunroof with a pillowcase stuffed with swag, then lit out down the freeway's shoulder in the direction of Buffalo. "He won't be the last," Lee Daniel said. "No," said McDermott. "I don't expect he will."
"But they're not fired," the Series B man said.
Lee Daniel didn't know either of the investors' names. Fucking spear carriers, fronts for unimaginable, implacable wealth, charged with returning 400% over 3 years on a national budget-sized fund. "Tell them," Lee Daniel said. "They don't listen when they're like this. They don't listen to people like you. Not ever."
"Get down," he said to Elaine.
She was wedged into a crook and tied off with an improvised harness made out of nylon rope and carabiners from her vest.
"We gotta get back to the bus."
"They'll shoot us," Elaine said.
"They can't see us," he said.
Laser sights danced in the fog. He heard the crack of Cobra's rifle.
"He's scared," Elaine said.
Next to her, also tied off, where did Elaine keep that many carabiners, was a young surveyor, one they'd just picked up in Montana, a kid with a shaved head who had shyly asked him for a job after meeting Elaine at the local Army-Navy store and getting a lecture on which gear to buy and why. He was wrapped around the branch like a serpent, locked at the ankles, thighs, and wrists.
"So am I," Lee Daniel said. "They're shooting. It's natural. Get him down. Push him off the branch if you have to."
"What about him?" she said, gesturing at the branch below her. There was another surveyor, a 40-something lunk who didn't wash enough and farted too much and blamed it on everyone. He was balding and his comb-over hung limply at one side of his head as he hugged the trunk.
"Push him too," Lee Daniel said.
The tablet stuck in his waistband spoke. It was the Series B man.
"Don't give them any more advice. You shouldn't be liable for what they do in this situation. Return to the bus."
Lee Daniel shrugged up at her, caught a whiff of gas that set his eyes to watering, and looked back at the clearing. Cobra was lying on his side, face away from them. The girl was holding his hand, face covered by a placid mask, but he heard her sob.
"Now, back to the bus!"
Lee Daniel climbed the tree. He got up to the first surveyor's branch, old Stinky, and he gave the man a shove. He fell like a stone. He stepped on Stinky's branch, grabbed the kid by an arm, and yanked hard. The kid dropped too.
"Down," he said to Elaine, and dropped, landing on the kid. "Leave them," the Series A man said. "We're not insured."
He helped the kid to his feet, then Stinky. In the clearing, the Sûreté had surrounded the girl. Her hands were up, glistening with blood. One turned towards them and shouted something in French, raising his, Her, hard to tell with a Martian armor, sidearm. Lee Daniel froze, and then a red dot appeared on the SQ's leg, traveling up to his, her, crotch. One of the other SQs pointed, and the SQ with the gun looked down and then dropped his, her, arm and leapt back. Elaine jumped down, holding her laser pointer in her hand. "Run!" Lee Daniel said, shoving at the two surveyors, then taking off, running blindly in the moonlight, whacking into tree trunks, tripping. The bus was crowded with cograds, and he vaulted up the steps and slammed into the driver's seat, authenticating on the palm reader and putting the bus through its warm-up, locked-down urban defense checklist. He was vaguely aware of more bodies coming in, and then he slammed the door close button as the shutters unrolled over the windows. He hit the internal lights, stood and turned around. "Count off!" he shouted over the buzz of conversation. Automatically, McDermott said, "One," as he had at every count since he'd signed on and gotten the first investor's chair. He turned to the Series A man expectantly. "Fuck that!" he said in an uncharacteristic burst of blue talk. "Drive, goddammit, now!" Lee Daniel pointed at him and said, "Two," then pointed at the Series B man and said, "Three." He pointed at the middle managers behind him, and they began to count off methodically. The Series A man turned around and shouted, "Shut the fuck up or I'll throw your ass off the fucking bus! Drive!" Lee Daniel looked at Mac. "Better drive, LD," he said. They were already 20 miles off from the res when Elaine told him that Stinky and the kid never got on the bus. Three more raiders looted equipment off the bus. Lee Daniel played a little game with himself, betting on which one would be the next to turn raccoon. He was 2 for 3 within 20 minutes. "Stop them," the Series A man said. "Why?" Lee Daniel said. "They'll ruin us," the Series B man said. "Huh, they'll ruin you," Lee Daniel said. "There go the satellite uplinks. Wow, good retirement benefit." "What do you want?" the Series A man asked. "Sell me your stake." "He sells Mac his stake. The paperwork's inside on the fax machine." "You're joking," the Series A man said. "That's the deal," Lee Daniel said. "And I don't see anyone offering anything better." There was a tinkle from the bus, and Joey Riel sped away with a stack of optical switches off into the night, staggering slightly from the burden and the booze. "I need to call the partners," the Series A man said. "You have 15 minutes. Better not take much longer," Lee Daniel said, as an expensive crash resounded from the direction whence Joey Riel had gone. 15 minutes, the Series B man said, whitening. "You want several weeks?" Lee Daniel said. He wiped his palms on his thighs and kept his grin off his face. It'd be good to get back into the driver's seat.
I wrote this story for Bruce Sterling's Turkey City Workshop in Austin, Texas. I was nervous and thrilled to be invited. Bruce is one of my idols, and he's now a friend and colleague, and my daughter's godfather besides. We'd corresponded, sat on panels together, but this was leveling up. It was a hell of a workshop, and it was also where I met Raph Koster, now also a good friend, as well as an astute and inspiring game designer and theorist. I'd admired a play by Dwayne Hendricks to use Indian land in the USA to test out cognitive radio applications, on the basis that these sovereign territories were not under FCC jurisdiction. He'd found various tribal leaders who were excited by the idea. Cognitive radio may just be the most radical game-changing technology on our immediate horizon, if it works. In the meantime, I couldn't shake my memories of the brutal standoff at Oka, Quebec. This is a Mohawk reservation whose sacred burial land the local town decided to expropriate for a golf course. The situation escalated, and soon there were heavily armed Mohawks and heavily armed cops and heavily armed soldiers all pointing automatic weapons at each other. I never forgot the desperate bravery of the Mohawk Warrior Society.